Hello once again, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it, which helps more people find it. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Membership gives you various exciting extras, which include an archive of a whopping 231 book reviews, written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East and Europe. The archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but now a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. Members also receive transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. Membership also gets you transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 80 conversations and well over 200,000 words. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. And finally, the previous deal that we had with the publisher IB Taurus ran until the end of 2018. IB Taurus got bought up by Bloomsbury last year and has been going through some changes, and I'm just waiting for confirmation on updating our discount deal for Turkey Book Talk members and should find out the details in the next few days. So of course I'll update you in due course, and fingers crossed we'll be able to once again offer a significant discount on books published in IB Taurus's excellent Turkey Ottoman History series. To become a member and help us keep going, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or by doing a quick Google search. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on with our latest episode. In it, we hear from Caroline Eden. She's the author of Black Sea, Dispatches and Recipes Through Darkness and Light, published by Quadrille. The book is a richly illustrated and handsomely put together part cookbook, part travelogue, describing places, people and recipes from the Black Sea coasts of Ukraine, Romania and Bulgaria. About half the book is on Turkey's own Black Sea coast, with lengthy stops in Istanbul, Trabzon and Rize. Needless to say, the book is very mouthwatering indeed and not one to read on an empty stomach. It also includes plenty of ruminations on the unique histories of the places that Caroline Eden stops at along the way. I started by asking her about how the idea or inspiration for the project first emerged.
So the idea for Black Sea, the seed was probably sown back in 2013. My husband and I decided to take a trip to Tbilisi in Georgia, somewhere that he was quite familiar with, but somewhere that I didn't know very well. And we thought a fun way to do it would be to take the train. So we set off from London and we travelled to Tbilisi by train and rail replacement bus. And when I got home and I started to think about the trip and all the things that I'd enjoyed along the way, the pavement cafes of Sofia and the churches and wonderful things that we'd seen, it was one moment that stuck with me stronger than everything else. And that was the moment when I first saw the Black Sea, which was in Turkey. It was by the port city of Samsun. And we'd been traveling all day in a very hot bus. And as we sort of approached the sea and it came into view, there's a sort of sense of calm and a sense of sort of spirituality that entered through the windows. And it felt very odd at the time, but then it sort of made sense because about 20 minutes before, there'd been a road traffic accident and quite a bad one. And nerves had been jangled in the bus. And then just sort of seeing these waves, and I remember they were kind of gunmetal grey, not blue. It just sort of calmed everybody down and people took their mobile phones out and started taking pictures. I don't know, it was just a moment. It's a moment with magnetism. And when I got home, I just kept thinking about it. And I thought, I've never felt something so strongly about a body of water before. And I started research and going to libraries and read around the subject, of which there is quite a lot. And a lot of food stories started to appear. And I thought it'd be interesting to find out more. I've always been a regular visitor to Istanbul, obviously not on the Black Sea, but sort of pleasingly close and with a lot of Black Sea people living in it. but I didn't know the other places so well. We had visited Trabzon on that very first trip, and something about that city had also strongly appealed to me. So that was where the idea came from.
And the book describes a whole range of different places and dishes and flavours. Just wonder, what would you say ties them all together as sort of distinct Black Sea characteristic food? You know, what is the X factor that's unique and can be found across the region?
I'm not sure there is one. I'd set out hoping that there would be this obvious one ingredient or this obvious one way of cooking that would sort of connect the cities and towns that I visit. And to be clear, I don't circumnavigate the whole of the Black Sea. It's a trip between Odessa in southern Ukraine, finishing in Trabzon with Istanbul kind of neatly in the middle. And I suppose, obviously, fish and seafood. So I was finding a lot of things like rapani, sea snails in Ukraine and Romania. And then Hamsi, was it the Black Sea anchovies across the Turkish coast when I did a few trips in the winter to Istanbul. There are familiar flavours. There's a lot of pickles. I mean, you'd find that anyway in Turkey and the Caucasus. These sort of go up obviously into Romania, Ukraine and Bulgaria. Lots of nuts, lots of dried fruits, polenta kept appearing, a love of rose petals, a love of tea. But these are not, you know, massively specific to the region. But I think what did connect the places that I visited on the trip was this sense of the frontier. So that is one of the very strong themes in the book, because I think there's a big difference between a watery border and a fixed land border. And a lot of these towns and cities and villages that I spent time in all had a shared sense of the frontier about them. So sort of belonging to the host country, and proudly so, but also kind of standing on their own to a certain degree as well. And I thought that was interesting and a theme that followed me as I went along.
And as you travel through, you pick up recipes and experiences and meet different people. How did you find all the unique local recipes that you include in the book? And how did you go about deciding which ones to include?
Well, it was obviously a fantastic book to research. So I've always eaten a lot on my travels around the world. The last sort of 25 years, I've been traveling, working as a travel writer, and just traveling for fun, obviously. And food is such a good way into a culture. It's rewarding. You share it. It's food is political, but it's something we all do three times a day. And it's a great way of breaking ground and sort of meeting people in markets and in restaurants and cafes. And I'm not ever going to claim to be any kind of authority on any of the cuisines of the countries that I travel through. This is really a travel book with recipes, and I sort of say that I see the recipes as photographs, as another way of showing people the journey, getting them to taste the journey as they read the book, if they wish to make the recipes along the way. So they were really snapshots of things that I ate along the way, and some of the things that I read about as well. So the first chapter, Odessa. Odessa is an incredibly literary place. Lots of the great Russian and Ukrainian writers of the 19th century spent time there. So we've got things like Gogol's marinated mushrooms and Mark Twain's debauched ice cream as recipe headers in the book. And those are just things that I based, you know, around reading their work, their books set in the city. So they're not all factual recipes. Some of them are sort of sprinkled with some imagination, but some of them are. And I was given a few recipes that I've included in the book. There's a fantastic börek in the Istanbul chapter, a Laz börek, which was completely new to me. Some of your listeners will certainly be familiar with it. But it was surprising because it's not a savoury börek. It's filled with custard and a little bit of black pepper and with no syrup on the top. And it was absolutely delicious. And I have recreated it, or done my best to recreate it at home. And when I go to Istanbul next week, I should be taking a copy of the book to the man that gave it to me. So I hope he's not going to be horrified with what I've done with it. But I did my best.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the photos, because they are extremely mouthwatering as you flick through the book. The book is put together very beautifully. It's like a very large hardback with a very nice cover and lavishly illustrated. But I haven't actually tried making any of the recipes, unfortunately, yet.
I think it's interesting with these books. You hope that people will cook the recipes. But I think with this book and my first book that I brought out, Samarkand, which is about Central Asia, which is really my area of interest for a long time, it's really to help open these places up to people that perhaps don't know very much about the places that I visit. So Samarkand was interesting because my book happened to come out at the same time of the death of Karimov, the former leader there, and Peter Frankopan's book on the Silk Roads, and Adolf documentary about the Silk Road, and all of that combined saw a spike of about a third increase of tourism to Central Asia, and especially to Uzbekistan, which is now really sort of starting to fly as a destination for sort of curious cultural travellers, I suppose. And I'd like to see the same happen a bit more, perhaps in cities like Trabzon. I think Trabzon has got so much to offer visitors, and obviously it has tourism. It has a lot of visitors from the Gulf, and I talk about this in the book, a lot of visitors from Saudi Arabia and Bahrain when we were there, who kind of find great joy in some of the things I think that puts us British travellers off. So, you know, cooler weather in the summer months, and rain, and sort of restaurants without, you know, that don't serve alcohol, which are perhaps not obvious things that Brits look for when they go on holiday. But of course, it's a city full of wonderful museums, of a really with a fascinating bazaar with Hagia Sophia and Somela Monastery. And each time I've been there, I have seen a handful of Western tourists. So it would be nice if people perhaps look to the northeast of Turkey and the Black Sea region as a place of interest to visit, because I think it really offers a lot.
Maybe the books coincided nicely with the crisis between the Ukraine and Russia. Not sure how positively that will affect tourism, though.
I mean, it's interesting because when I was researching this book, we were in Istanbul a lot in 2016, 2017. So those were interesting times in that city there. Odessa really does sit on its own. It's quite some distance from eastern Ukraine and Crimea, but certainly it was interestingly impacted mainly by what had happened in Istanbul. So with terrorism and the attempted coup, this really decimated all of the Black Sea cruising for tourism, you know, so there were no cruises going to Yalta or sort of other Black Sea destinations. And people in Odessa had been affected very badly by this. So they were very keen that things settled down in Istanbul so that they would get their Black Sea cruises returning to the port.
Now, the book, you actually start in Odessa in Ukraine, and you travel down through Romania, Bulgaria, into Turkey, Istanbul, and as mentioned, across the Turkish Black Sea coast to Trabzon. And you start in Odessa, and you spend a lot of time talking about Odessa, its kind of inherent literary quality that people mention, its historic cosmopolitanism. It has this really unique history, and of course, its cuisine. Really does get across this idea that Odessa is a really remarkable place. And again, that is somewhere that definitely is now, well, it was on my list before, but it's probably gone further up the list, I think, thanks to this book.
Very good. Well, Turkish Airlines, as we were doing the research, my husband and I travelled, and we travelled together for a lot of this. We were flying between Istanbul and Odessa. So very, very easy to get there from there, just to nip up the Black Sea, and highly recommended. I had a couple of friends living in Istanbul who went on my recommendation and had a really fantastic time. You can go to the opera for, you know, $2, and you can eat amazingly well. Unfortunately, Ukraine's faltering economy is a benefit for the visitor in the sense that it's extremely good value. And it's just wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful at any time of year, but in the summer, it's a very special place.
Yeah, I wonder, can you get down there easily from Kiev and Lviv? Because it might be nice to combine them.
Yeah, you can certainly take an overnight train from Kiev. I've actually never been to Lviv, so I can't comment on that. But yes, I've not done the overnight train ride, but I met a man once. I was doing an interview in the one of the synagogues there, and he'd just done that overnight train journey, and he was quite tired. So I think it would be an adventure to do it by train. Probably good fun.
And quite aside from trying out all the recipes and whatnot, the book also made me want to read Isaac Babel, and specifically his short stories, The Odessa Tales.
Yeah, I mean, I rave about Babel in the book. A friend of mine, Boris Dreliuk, who's a very, very good translator of Russian, brought out a new translation of Isaac Babel's Odessa stories, just as I was starting to research heavily the Odessa chapter. And it's just wonderful. I mean, I knew about Babel, but I hadn't really read him in any detail. And he is really Odessa's literary son. So the joke goes that they have this fabulous statue of Babel in downtown Odessa, and they raise the money twice as fast as they did for the one that they have of Pushkin. So, I mean, Russians love Pushkin, and Odessa, while it's Ukrainian, is a Russian-speaking city, and they love Pushkin too. But Babel is really the one, and he describes Odessa in such fantastic ways. And while he's obviously not a food writer per se, writes about food and uses food to describe situations, greediness, wheeling and dealing and swindling that went on in the sort of catacombs and under the city very, very well. And it's very funny. It stands up today. And I think Boris's new translation did open it up to a lot of new readers. And everyone should read Babel. I mean, he's just brilliant.
And from Ukraine, you head down through Romania and you spend some time in Constanța, which is this quite forlorn, sort of almost forgotten Black Sea coastal town. What did you find there?
I had a big soft spot for Constanța, actually. I think it's one of these places where it's a bit Marmite. You kind of either like it or you don't. Forlorn's a very good word to describe it. It does feel like that. I was there during their Navy Day celebrations, which was quite interesting because it's a big holiday and it brought in a lot of outsiders and it was very busy. But it still had a certain sadness to it. And I think, again, it's that sense of being a frontier place. It's ancient. So before it was Thomas, you know, it was where Ovid was exiled to. It's got a working mosque, which I thought was very interesting, which is a handsome mosque you can freely go in and visit. And the star of Constanța, which everybody talks about if they've been, is the casino. And the casino sits on a bluff right on the Black Sea. So the waves of the Black Sea are literally slapping it. And it's the most fantastic building. It's, I would say, one of the most amazing ruined buildings in Europe. And we were extremely lucky to get permission to go in and take photographs. And unfortunately, because Constanța only has a very small slice of the book, Turkey takes up about half, we don't have an awful lot of the photos in the book. But the photographer, Theodore Kay, who's a friend and is incredibly talented, got in, took pictures of the wonderful casino. And it's just falling down. It's a sort of hard to describe what it looks like. It stands alone on the waterfront. It's got these incredible shell-shaped windows. It's sort of Art Nouveau to look at. Opened to the public in 1910, and it hosted a sort of invading Red Army officers in 1944. And then it sort of operated as a restaurant. And unfortunately, it's sort of fallen into disrepair since. And I think if it was sort of anywhere else in the world, it would almost certainly be a five-star hotel or a restaurant because it's a wonderful looking building. But that's kind of Constanța. You don't feel like it's had very much sort of love and care. It just feels a bit, it does feel forlorn. But again, interesting. Very, very nice museums, nice restaurants, very good value to visit, and kind of charming. But you have to sort of go there with an open mind, perhaps.
Now, the sections in the book on Istanbul are very generous indeed. I learned plenty of new things, but I was pleasantly surprised to see a couple of pages devoted to Fucin, which is basically this sort of institution, really, just off Istiklal Caddesi. It's almost taken over an entire street, and I'm sure many of the listeners will already know it. It's been running for decades. It specialises in Circassian food. Just talk about Fucin a little bit.
Well, I, first of all, someone that was working at the hotel I was staying at suggested it for lunch. So I went there first, not really knowing anything about it, and had a good lunch there. And then I think I was telling somebody, I guess this is how it always works in Istanbul, I was telling somebody else about it. And they said, oh, you know, it's got really interesting Black Sea reach. You should go and speak to Leyla, who works there, one of the sisters. So I did go there and had a very interesting interview with a translator, because I don't speak Turkish, who told me about her life and her a little bit about her family background. Some of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar. It's quite an interesting background. So North Ossetia in the North Caucasus, or the Caucasus, obviously under Soviet rule for a long time. And her family had been in Istanbul, I think, for about 150 years. And she'd only very recently gone back to visit. And the most interesting thing she said was that their traditions, really, as far as culinary traditions, had been better preserved in Turkey than they had been back there, because communism had kind of flattened it slightly. Whereas in Turkey, they'd been left to their own devices and had held on to their Ossetian pies and sour cream porridges and interesting heritage recipes. So I kind of like that. She said something like, we kept our cornbread recipes back there. They're sort of folklore, you know, they've sort of become a thing of legend because they're just not there like they were. So I think it was almost like a sad return, but it's just a great place to eat. I mean, I've been back several times since. The Circassian ravioli is very good. The potato dumplings, great service. I like the fact it's sort of, they've got nothing, they're now commanding the alleyway that they're on, aren't they? They've sort of got three cafes along there. I recommend it to people if they haven't been. I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know it, but perhaps newer ones. But yeah, it's a great place. It sort of sums up Istanbul to me. All of these smaller cafes, or many of them, have such interesting stories to be told and specialise in one or two dishes very, very well. So yeah.
And obviously a big part of the Black Sea coast is part of Russia, but the book doesn't travel to the Russian Black Sea coast. However, Russia sort of lingers like a really big historical spectre over all the places that you describe, yeah. Particularly while talking about white Russian emigres to Istanbul in the years after the First World War. There were tens of thousands of them, and many of them lived and settled in Karaköy and Galata, and they had this big cultural impact in a number of areas, and also, of course, an impact on cuisine in Istanbul. But despite that big impact, there are almost no, on the surface at least, traces of that in today's Istanbul. It's very strange in a way.
Well, that's what I thought. And this is one of the things that struck me with the book, because in Odessa, you know, Odessa nowadays, unfortunately, many of the Jews that made up a height, I think it's about a third or even half at some points, you know, half the population of people living in Odessa, their numbers were decimated by the Romanian allied Nazis. And unfortunately, those that were left, a lot of them made aliyah to Israel and left, or they moved to the US. And their heritage and legacy is quite obvious and on the surface. So you've got synagogues, you've got people serving Jewish food in non-Jewish cafes. They've got a little Jewish museum, which is very interesting. But then you go to Istanbul and you start to dig around looking for history of the white Russians, and there's not an awful lot left. There's obviously the rooftop churches in Karaköy, which are very interesting. And I went up to visit one, and you've got restaurants like Rejon's, but there's not an awful lot. And I was quite surprised, really. The hotel, the Pera Palace, you know, they have a few postcards of when the white Russians used to drink at the bar there. And they came in great numbers. It wasn't just like it was a few, you know, it was thousands and thousands. But Istanbul's a very, very big city. And I suppose it's been a great place of refuge for many different groups of people who've fled across the Black Sea over the decades. And yeah, I was surprised that there wasn't more to be found.
There was recently an exhibition here, actually. It was about the beach culture of early Republican Turkey, and the white Russians actually apparently had a very big influence on that. They were sort of the pioneers, really, of these sort of beach facilities that dotted the coasts around Istanbul. And of course, those facilities have now basically all disappeared as well, which is quite a kind of appropriate, at least, symbol of that sort of white Russian influence, I suppose. There's also, of course, the Ayaz Pasha restaurant, which is still there. I went a few years ago, and it seemed your description of it was exactly actually as I remember it. It's kind of rather sad place with pretty average food. There was sort of almost nobody else was in when I went. I almost can't believe it's still going after all these years. There's 1924, which is another restaurant that you're a bit lukewarm about, even though it has a certain style about it. I mean, how would you compare those two institutions?
Well, so I write a bit in the book about 1924, which I'm hoping to visit next week. Do you know if it's open? Well, because it seems to be one of these restaurants in Istanbul which closes and reopens at regular intervals, and one is never sure.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I was planning, having read the book, I was planning on going just for the pure sort of style over substance.
Well, that's the thing. And to be fair, when I went, I actually had an amazingly good night there because it's got so much atmosphere.
Yeah.
I remember the vodka trolley, you know, rattling over the tiles and the peeling labels, you know, cinnamon. And I think there was even a salmon infused vodka. And I'm not sure I'd be brave enough to order that. But it's, you know, it is what it is. And it's again, very Istanbul. I'm not sure if it would exist anywhere else. But I guess that's incredibly expensive real estate where it is. So I wonder, yeah, if it will remain open for much, much longer. And as with the Ayia Pasha one, I suppose that's sort of been on its knees a little bit since Judith, the sort of white Russian emigre who was running it for many years, departed this world. And I suppose now it's sort of the very cheerful Turkish chap that's running it maybe doesn't have quite the same passion. I don't know, but he's a fluent Russian speaker. He was speaking Russian when I was there. And I think I describe it as having a sense of suspended animation. That was kind of how it felt, but it was fine. I think I had a chicken Kiev or something when I was there. But yeah, we struggled to find much more. I think the church that we visited was the highlight. I think it's quite remarkable that they're there.
Yeah, they're doing services on the roof, aren't they? Or?
Yeah, they're in the roof in Karakoy. So it's called, I'm going to mispronounce this, Aya Pantelemon. I think you pronounce it something similar to that. And it's one of four, I think, remaining rooftop Russian churches. And they just look like apartment blocks until you sort of go up all these stairs. And I think it's something like six flights or so. And if there are any incredibly old remaining white Russians, for sure they're not going to be able to make it up those stairs. So, yeah, I don't know for how much longer. But I was there for a service, and there was singing, and there was about four of us all together. So, yes, it's an interesting experience.
And from Istanbul, you head across to Trabzon and Rize. Now, Rize is known today as the tea-growing part of Turkey. Obviously, Turkey has a very high tea consumption rate. And Rize is a very distinctive place. And Turkey is among the top five tea-producing countries in the world. But perhaps not many people will know that tea being grown in Rize is actually a very modern thing. It basically started in the 1920s, so not even 100 years ago.
Right.
I just wonder if you could talk us through, you know, how and why this area became the tea capital of the region.
Well, it did. So the father of Turkish tea, Hulusi Karadeniz — Karadeniz obviously means Black Sea in Turkey. I mean, that's what I've been told the name was. It seems quite remarkable. But he sort of started Turkey's tea store in the 1920s. And the myth sort of goes that he carried the seeds from the Caucasus to grow in his garden. And I think by the late 1930s, the first tea crop was started around Rize. The reason tea grows in this part of Turkey, and it does look like Sri Lanka, they've got these incredible steppe emerald green tea plantations, it's because it's quite humid and wet and almost monsoonal. And that's because you get hot air rising in Central Asia, cooling with the Black Sea sort of damp winds, which is ideal for tea growing. And obviously, yes, the Turks are incredible tea drinkers, you know, no problem sort of eight glasses one after the next. But one of the little facts that I found out about Turkish tea that I loved was I understand this to be true, that Turks will say that if it's the colour of rabbit's blood, you know, very dark red, it's ready. And that is what I think of when I think of Turkish tea, because obviously I drink quite sort of milky British sort of style tea, but in Turkey it's so delicious, it's so refreshing. It does have that red hue to it, sort of amber coloured almost, very clean and fresh. I think you can't beat Turkish tea, but it never tastes the same when I drink it back here. I have to have it in Turkey to really enjoy it.
And you've obviously written this book, just published it, and been promoting it. Previously, you wrote about the cuisine of Central Asia, parts of Central Asia. I wonder what's next on the agenda. Have you thought ahead to the next project, or what are you working on at the moment?
I'm not really working on a book project just yet. I think it's when you bring a book out and it's been a big project, and this was quite a big project because I know Central Asia quite well, but the Black Sea was quite a learning curve for me, and it was wonderful research projects. I so enjoyed it, and all the journals that accompanied the research. But I think it's important to put one book out and kind of have a rest and collect your thoughts and enjoy the process of launching it a bit before you sort of go full throttle into the next one. But I would say, while I think Samarkand was a very good introduction to Central Asia — Central Asia is a ginormous region. Kazakhstan's the ninth largest country in the world. So there's a lot more to be said about that region. So possibly back there. I'd love to explore the North Caucasus, not the safest place in the world. Yeah. But yeah, not sure. For now, I'm having a rest and enjoying being in the Black Sea of the mind, and seeing, speaking to people like you, Will, and hearing about how the book's being received and what people have to say about it. So that's really fun. I'm enjoying that.
That was Caroline Eden. Many thanks to her. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member if you enjoy the podcast and want to help support it. Membership gets you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 80 conversations so far. Members also get access to an archive of 231 book reviews written by me, covering Turkish history and politics, literature and various other things. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. And if you're personally not sure, then why not consider signing up as a gift for a friend or colleague who may be interested. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.